On this week's 51%, we speak with sociologist Gretchen Sisson about her book Relinquished, on the politics of private adoption and how some agencies pressure struggling moms to relinquish their children.
Most adoptions are not like this, but enough of them are that the system is very willing to tolerate it.
We also discuss how the fall of Roe v. Wade may or may not impact adoption. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Adoption is often presented as a solution to abortion. If you don't want a pregnancy, why not just carry it to term anyway and give it to a loving family? You don't have to be a mom, but you also don't have to get an abortion, and another person who wants a baby gets to have one. So everyone's happy, right? Well, our guest today pushes back on that idea, and her overall stance on private adoption may be difficult for some to hear. Gretchen Sisson is a sociologist with the program Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health at the University of California, San Francisco. For a decade, Sisson has been interviewing moms across the U.S. who relinquished their children to private adoption agencies. Her research on the relationship between adoption and abortion has contributed to long-running works like the Turnaway Study and was cited by the Supreme Court's dissent in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, the case that ultimately overturned Roe v. Wade. Sisson says the majority of women who are denied abortion do not choose to give their babies up for adoption at the end of the day, unless, again, they are forced to. She questions whether adoption is a reproductive choice at all, because many of the women she spoke with were pressured financially and socially, and in some cases, they were outright manipulated by the agencies that approached them. Years later, she says many of them felt traumatized by the separation, even if they had a good relationship with their child's adoptive family, and even if they didn't want to be mothers in the first place. Her new book, Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood, paints a picture of who we force to be moms, who we allow to be moms, and which families are separated. Notably, Sisson's work focuses on private adoption, not state-mandated separation or the foster care system, but she says the long-running history of the latter continues to influence the former.
There's two histories that are not independent, but there's the broader history of family separation in the United States and globally. And those are all stories of different reasons why children do not grow up with the families that they were born into. And that can happen for any number of reasons. And in the book, I chart these histories of family separation due to American enslavement, where the selling of children or the selling of parents away from their children or children away from their parents was a form of punishment, but also a way of extracting obedience from enslaved families, right? That the threat of family separation was used as a way of policing enslaved families. I've also looked at the history of family separation around Native families with boarding schools and the Indian Adoption Project and today's challenges to the Indian Child Welfare Act, where the removal of Native children was about an attack on Native culture and tribes and tribal sovereignty. And this was a form of coercive and forced assimilation, whereby removing children from tribes, you could effectively end the impact of tribes on the next generation of Native children. And it was a direct attack on tribal continuity and sovereignty. So those are different stories of family separation that are apart from what we understand as the private domestic adoption system, but that still inform what family separation, including private adoption, looks like today. So when you look at the history of separating Black families during enslavement, during the Jim Crow era, through today with the disproportionate impact in the child welfare systems, the ways that we interpret poverty as neglect for the purposes of child removal, you still see the hauntings of these past systems. But there's also the separate history of private domestic adoption in the United States. And The formal system of private adoption is relatively historically new. It's only about 150 years old or so. Before that, if you had families that couldn't afford their children, you would actually have, you know, poor families, usually in urban centers, sending their children to baby farms where they would have to pay for their children to be cared for, right? There was no market demand for babies. And we didn't see that shift really until, really in significant volume, until the early 20th century. And that is really when the private system took root. There was more of a market value for children. There was more of a sentimental value placed on children, a desire for parenthood. And you began to see more and more of a demand for adoptable babies. And ever since this private system has evolved, you have seen generation after generation say, we don't have enough babies to adopt, right? The demand for adoptable babies has always surpassed the number of babies that are available. And I talk about this history because this demand is really what shapes so much of the practice of infant adoption today. When we live in a capitalistic society and you have a high demand and you have low supply, then you are incentivizing players to find ways of increasing supply.
So what were some of the ways that the women you spoke to were approached? I guess, you know, what were some of the ways you found private adoption agencies trying to increase supply?
I want to acknowledge this is an uncomfortable way of talking about people, right? We're talking about a market of children, and that is uncomfortable. I use that language very intentionally and not glibly because it is true. And I think that if we want to get at the heart of what adoption is and how it works, you need to use that language to understand what it's accomplishing for the people that are being impacted. But when we look at the ways that adoption agencies and adoption attorneys and other for-profit brokers that work in this space work, they are really targeting vulnerable pregnant people. And so you see adoption agencies that are using geofencing. They will geofence certain perimeters around abortion clinics, around methadone treatment facilities, around public hospitals, anywhere that someone who is pregnant and facing a crisis might go. And they will make sure that, you know, if your phone is entering these geofenced areas, that you're going to start getting targeted advertising for their agency or for their law practice or for their matching services. And they're really going to sell not just a particular set of services, but the idea of adoption broadly, the idea that adoption is inevitably going to give your child a better life. The idea that adoption is the most selfless and loving thing that a mother in crisis can do for her baby. That is sort of the lightest touch that you can find, where you have this sort of somewhat predatory, manipulative advertising targeting people who are vulnerable. Then you have agencies that will intentionally move mothers that they're working with across state lines. Adoption policy varies greatly state by state. And you have some states that have shorter revocation periods, that have less burdensome consent requirements, that maybe might not have any paternal consent requirements or easily waive paternal consent requirements. And so you'll have agencies move pregnant mothers to these states. They'll provide housing, they'll provide a lot of assistance for them throughout their pregnancy. And that creates the sense of obligation that now someone is owed your baby. They'll also engage in pre-birth matching. And pre-birth matching is one of those complicated things, because if the adoption is going to occur and it's going to be a successful open adoption, then it's important to begin the foundation for that lifelong relationship soon. But pre-birth matching also confers this obligation that a, you know, pregnant person really owes her baby to these loving prospective parents who are very excited for a child. And then you have practices that go very clearly into the fraudulent, where if a mother has been receiving housing assistance, food assistance, medical assistance during her pregnancy. Some agencies will then tell her after the baby is born if she's having complicated feelings about the idea of relinquishing and terminating her parental rights. They'll say, well, that's fine. You don't have to terminate your parental rights. But if you don't, then we're going to prosecute you for fraud, for lying. Or if you do, you're going to owe us for all your medical care that you received while you were pregnant, for all of the housing that we gave you. You're going to have to pay back that debt if you decide to parent. Or they'll say, we know you're not prepared for this baby. We know you don't have a car seat. We know you don't have a crib at home. So if you leave the hospital with your baby, we're going to call Child Protective Services on you and have them remove the baby. These are not the norm. And I want to be clear, most adoptions are not like this, but enough of them are that the system is very willing to tolerate it and not feed out these bad actors. And even the quote unquote good actors are still engaging in this targeted advertising. They'll still sell the idea of open adoption. One really progressive adoption agency for a long time would target mothers who had lost older children to foster care. And they would say, you know, if you've lost other children to foster care, you're probably going to lose this baby to foster care. And if you choose to place your baby through a private adoption with us, then you can choose the parents, you can have an open adoption, and you can have more control over the situation. Now, it's not a foregone conclusion that this mother is going to lose custody of this baby to foster care. And this also alludes the fact that the primary purpose of foster care is supposed to be reunification, is supposed to give this mother, these parents, you know, a path to regaining custody of the child, a path that is foreclosed with a private adoption. And so even these really progressive agencies will find these ways of targeting pregnant people. And a lot of times they'll market the idea of open adoption, even if they are in a state that doesn't have any legally enforceable openness to their adoptions. A lot of times these are just sort of gentlemen's agreements, rather than actually legally enforceable openness contracts.
Man, you know, like in those more extreme scenarios, it certainly sounds like there isn't much of a choice really at all. But, you know, what reasons did you see women giving for why they relinquished at the end of the day?
The biggest contributing factor for the vast majority of mothers that I interviewed was poverty. Most of these mothers were either living in chronic poverty or they might have a very middle-class background, but they happened to be broke during their pregnancy. They didn't have a living wage. They didn't have stable housing. They couldn't find a way of accessing that level of stability that they wanted before the baby was born. For the most part, these were not mothers that had a lot of power over their circumstances. Some of them were in relationships with someone that they felt was an unsafe partner for them. They felt would be an unsafe co-parent for a baby. And they didn't have the resources to move out. Maybe they're living with their own parents still, and their parents are not supportive of them parenting, and they can't afford their own home. For some of them, they were working, they were in, you know, stable, good relationships. But there was one woman I interviewed, she's like, look, I was making $9 an hour. I couldn't afford a car seat and a crib. And I would have needed, you know, what she says is I would have needed just $1,000 for my life to change. And people push back on that and say, well, how far is $1,000 really going to go? Like $1,000 isn't, like babies are really expensive. What are you going to do with $1,000? And she's not saying she needs $1,000 to raise her child. She needs $1,000 to feel like she has another choice, to feel like she can buy that crib and that car seat and see a space in her life where a baby can fit. She needs $1,000 for just a little bit of breathing room so that she can take some time off of work for maternity leave. Most of these women who are working, they didn't have paid leave. They didn't necessarily even have a guaranteed job if they had to take leave. They wouldn't necessarily have something to go back to. So they're living in positions of precarity that were overwhelmingly financial precarity that led them to relinquish their children.
We're speaking with Gretchen Sisson, author of Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. I gotta say, you know, a lot of what you're telling me, it makes me sad. I mean, adoption is widely talked about like a good thing. You're taking a child out of a difficult situation that could potentially be traumatic and hopefully giving them a loving home. I know people who've adopted. I know people who have been adopted. Growing up, it was something that, you know, I told myself that maybe I would like to do one day too. And, you know, you do point out in your book that for some parents, adoption is a primary way to make a family, you know, for LGBTQ plus couples or for those who struggle with infertility. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is what should we make of all of this? If you are considering adoption, I guess, do you have any advice or what should they be thinking? What should they know about it?
I mean, this is a tough question. And I think there are a couple of parts to it. So I think a lot of people are interested in the idea of adoption because they believe that adoption is about caring for children. And I would argue that the private adoption system is rarely about caring for children. And it is almost always about the desires of prospective adoptive parents. You know, we have up to 45 waiting prospective parents for every baby that is relinquished in private adoption in the United States. We do not have a shortage. We do not need more people to want to adopt in the private system in order to care for children in this country. And I think that that's important for people to understand. And the higher that number grows of people who want to adopt, you're just increasing the pressure on that market system. So the more and more you will incentivize players to go out and increase the supply. But I believe that most people who want to adopt are coming to it with a set of altruistic purposes of wanting to care for children. And I would say we always need more people to want to care for children in this country. We just don't necessarily need more people who want to adopt. And I think that there are different ways we can think about doing that. We can think about that as caring for a whole family, right? A lot of these women that I interviewed were young, they were pregnant, they wanted to care for their child. Many of them already had older children they were struggling to care for. There is an opportunity to find ways of caring for families that allow them to stay together. There are also families that are going to be in crisis. Not every person is going to be able to care for every child to whom they give birth at every point in their life, right? I say this all of the time. And we need more opportunities for crisis care. So some of the mothers that I interviewed found out they were pregnant very late in their pregnancy, 39 weeks. Some of them, you know, went into labor and that was when they knew that they were pregnant. And the reason that they relinquished is because they didn't have time to even wrap their mind around what was happening to them, let alone prepare for a baby. And if they had had a crisis care option or someone who would have been able to care for the baby for a couple of weeks or longer while they sort of figured it out and given them room to get their feet under them and create a home that they could bring the child to, that could have been really valuable for them. We need more foster parents who aren't interested in adopting, who will care for a child while a parent recovers from a mental health crisis, an addiction, and that might be the work of many years. But private adoption requires the permanent legal separation of a child from their family of origin. And, you know, it's premised on the idea that parenting in a nuclear family is the only type of care for children that we value in our culture. And I think that there's a huge opportunity to begin to shift that and to say, what does it mean to love a child, to make sure that a child has the safety, the stability, the care that they need to thrive while maintaining a connection as much as possible to their family of origin, whether that's contact, whether that's a legal tie, you know, whether that's temporary care or longer term care or guardianship. if people are considering adopting because they want to meet a child's needs, those are the conversations that we need to be having.
I know your book doesn't really focus on the experience of children who are adopted, but for bio moms, what impacts do you see the decision to relinquish having on them?
Well, I don't study adoptees, and I always really like to lift up a lot of the adoptee voices. And there are so many brilliant adoptee writers out there. Melissa Guida Richards wrote a book, What White Parents Should Know About Transracial Adoption. Angela Tucker wrote a brilliant book called You Should Be Grateful, right? Which is pushing back on the idea that adoptees must always be grateful for having been adopted. Of course, Nicole Chung with All You Can Ever Know, which is a beautiful memoir. And I mention these particularly because Melissa, Nicole, Angela, you know, I believe they would all say that they had really loving, lovely adoptive parents and homes. They were not unhappy with their adoptive families. These were not, you know, a bad experience or one of these, you know, really egregious examples of an abusive adoptive home. You can find those as well, and I'm not dismissing them. But what these writers, what these voices highlight is the way that you can still be deeply critical of a system, even if you feel like it served you well in some ways. But as far as the impact on relinquishing parents, it's complicated because many of the mothers I interviewed, if I talked to them soon after their adoption, they were quite happy. They were very optimistic, right? Because they're usually still in a really vulnerable, the same vulnerable place that they were in during their pregnancy. So if they felt they didn't have enough money to care for this child, they probably still don't have any more money. All of the reasons for the adoption are still very tangible in their life. And whatever they have been told adoption would do for them and their child, that all still feels very possible. So they're at a very optimistic place. Over time, though, many of them, almost all of them, came to a far more critical understanding of the system and how it worked and what it meant for them and their child. So for some of them, this meant that their adoptions were closed. The adoptive parents cut off contact with them or limited contact with them, or they just saw that adoption, the promises of the adoption weren't being fulfilled. Many of them also saw their child struggling in some ways with being adopted. This is particularly true for mothers of children who were in transracial adoptions, who were trying to understand what adoption meant for their own racial and ethnic identities. And so broadly, most of the mothers that I interviewed came to this more cynical way of understanding the adoption as time went on. People always ask, did they regret their decision? And I'll say regret is a very complicated way of thinking about it. Because for some of the mothers who felt like they had almost no choice in the adoption, they would say, well, no, I don't regret the adoption because I didn't make this choice, right? This was kind of pushed upon me. So from their perspective, it wasn't a choice. And so they don't have anything to regret. But that doesn't mean that they're not happy. It doesn't mean that they are happy with the situation, right? But there was one mother who shared me, and she put it in a really poignant way because, she relinquished her first child and went on and got married and had another daughter that she was raising. And for her, her children felt mutually exclusive in a way. So if she had raised her first daughter, would she have married this partner and would she have the daughter that she was raising? And so when I said, do you regret this? I was asking her to, you know, the way she understood that question was, do you wish you had a different life that doesn't involve your other child? And so, and she said that, she said, I don't know that I would choose parenting her over the life that I have now. But if there is a life where I could have both of my children with me, that's what I would choose. And so I think that that gets to the heart of how so many mothers had really complicated feelings about their adoption and the relationships that they had with the children they relinquished over the course of their lives, that were more nuanced than just do you regret this or not.
Well, Gretchen, thank you so much for taking the time. You know, finally, you know, I wanted to ask, over the course of the Supreme Court case Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, you heard justices like Amy Coney Barrett talking about adoption as an alternative to abortion. So how do you see adoption playing a role in a post-Roe landscape?
So I was part of a research study that looked at what happens when women are denied access to abortions that they want as part of the Turnaway study. And my brilliant colleague, Diana Foster, was the lead investigator on that. And she has a book called The Turnaway Study that I would heartily recommend to anyone who's interested in understanding what it means for women to be denied access to abortion care. But what we found among this sample of women was that among those denied access to abortions, 91% of them were parenting the children to whom they gave birth. You know, they were parenting in circumstances that they didn't plan, with partners they didn't prefer, with timing they didn't choose. But they were raising those children that were born of those pregnancies. Only 9% had relinquished. Now that 9% is huge when you compare it to the 0.5% of all babies that of all births that are relinquished. So it is a big increase that way. But you're going to have far more people parenting as a result of abortion denials and abortion bans than you are going to have adoptions. So we don't necessarily, so the adoption rate is not going to skyrocket the way that some might suspect, but it is going to increase significantly. We don't have federal tracking. We don't track adoptions on a federal level. There is a bill in front of Congress now. I don't think it will go anywhere this session, the remainder of this session, but I'm sure it will be introduced next session to actually collect data on that so that we can say more definitively what the impact of these things are, but we don't know that now. So I think adoption will increase. I don't think it will be nearly as much as people suspect. We have to understand, and I think that this gets at the heart of what I try to share in my research and why I have so much gratitude for the women who shared their stories with me. We have to understand that the framework of choice, the framework of reproductive choice, that you can parent or you can have an abortion or you can choose adoption. This is a really false narrative, and it doesn't look at the ways that pregnant people are making these decisions in the context of their whole lives. And this is why access to abortion is an economic issue, why conversations about adoption belong in conversations about, you know, criminal justice and family policing. None of these issues are separate from each other. And we need to understand the totality of people's lives and the ways that reproductive choices are part of that and at the root of that. And we cannot just continue to frame these political conversations as about choice. And we really must make these conversations about justice and how to care for people.
Gretchen Sisson is a sociologist with the University of California, San Francisco, and the author of Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. It's out now through St. Martin's Press, and you can find it at most major booksellers. To learn more about Gretchen's work, you can check out her website, gretchensisson.com. Gretchen, thanks for joining us today.
Of course, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little